Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, Frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Stu does America.
Coming up on Stu Does America, Drew Holden is here. He's going to explain how holding the mainstream media accountable for their multitude of failures is a good idea. I've got an update on Trump's Florida Veep Steaks weekend, and we're going to start by doing the plot against KJP. And sometimes I think about, you think about all the insiders in Washington, and you think, what is it with these people? Are they just totally different than us? And the answer to that is not really. Like, for example, the same conversations you're having about Joe Biden and how he looks mentally incompetent and he maybe has dementia are the same conversations they're having behind the scenes in Washington. The issue is they have different loyalties. You are, of course, looking for the best thing, best outcome for the country. They are looking to keep their jobs and often keep themselves in power. Now, they may have some moral justification as to why that's the most important thing. But that's generally speaking how they look at it. They want to get through a crisis, not address it. And the same thing is going on with Corinne Jean-Pierre, because we've all had the same conversations here in the regular country and in Washington, D.C., where basically the question is, like, how does she have this job? Like they've seen these press conferences, right? Like, this isn't like, what's going on here? And of course, these conversations were happening in Washington as well. There's a new bit of reporting out from the New York Post talking about an attempted coup, essentially, on Corinne Jean-Pierre. Inside the failed White House coup to oust Biden Press Secretary Corinne Jean-Pierre. And this, a lot of this comes from insiders inside of the White House, but also from longtime Biden and left-wing political hacks, people who've been around this for a long time, Anita Dunn being one of them. De facto White House communications chief Anita Dunn, 66, the wife of Biden personal secretary attorney Bob Bauer, told colleagues that she had decided to call in prominent Democrats to explain to Jean-Pierre, 49, that the time was ripe to move on, sources told the Post. This is an incredible paragraph. Because who the hell thought Corinne Jean-Pierre was 49 years old? I can't believe she's older than I am. I don't know if it was her mental intellect that gave me this impression. She looks younger than 49, but I don't know that that's it. It's just the fact that she has the intellect of an 18-year-old, and so I can't believe she's 49 years old. I'm literally stunned by that. Stunned by it. Also, it's kind of interesting that the other press communications folks are trying to take her out. The source told the Post that Dunn claimed that White House Chief of Staff Jesse Zients knew about and supported the cloak and dagger scheme to push Jean-Pierre out of the West Wing. A second source told the Post that Jeff and Anita were trying to find Corinne a graceful exit because of the ugly optics of removing her against her will. This is, of course, another example of the left eating its own, right? They've created these DEI initiatives and all of these principles that diversity is our strength. And then when you have someone who just happens to be African-American and gay, I believe. Don't quote me on that one. But a couple of different of the intersectional points, you can't remove them because it would look bad for you because you've been saying how diversity is your strength the whole time. The revelation of Dunn's plan is likely to make for an awkward workplace dynamics, the first source said, but is unlikely to result in Jean-Pierre's departure. She has been pretty consistent in telling people from the minute she got the job that she was going to stay through the election. They said, I think Corinne decided to come hell or high water, and that's it. Okay, so now, of course, the White House has come out and responded to this. They say Andrew Bates told the Post, not only are these claims wildly false, but the reality is the polar opposite. Of course it is. Corinne was never approached by anyone with such a message. She spends 4 hours preparing every day, and neither Jeff or Anita did any such thing. Both have been unflinchingly supportive of her. Now, of course, that's not true, but the fascinating part about that is they're bragging that she works 4 hours a day. She preps for 4 hours a day. Well, don't overexert yourself there, Corinne. I mean, you got to think of how much time she's spending picking out her new outfits, that she has to pick a new one every single day. Understandably, she can only prep for the job for 4 hours. And she reads every word of these press conferences. How is she prepping? I don't understand how she's prepping. She's just reading this off. Is she writing every word of the prep stuff? Because it doesn't look like she's ever seen it before when she's out there. Maybe she's just bad at this. But the idea of a graceful exit has been something you might remember from months past. Why on earth would the press secretary for the president in the middle of an election year get some high-profile job offer from another Democratic institution? It makes no sense. That's not what should happen, right? You wouldn't want to steal someone from that role. Well, that offer did come. White House spokesperson Corinne Jean-Pierre turned down a chance to run Emily's List. Now, Emily's List is one of the worst organizations on the planet. Basically, it raises a bunch of money to get Democrats elected, specifically Democrats who support abortion rights. So they're basically an organization that exists to make sure that children don't live, which is an amazing thing to pursue. And something that I think, you know, would fit, a Corinne Jean-Pierre. What are you doing in that role, right? Like, you're meeting with people occasionally, you're trying to get money out of them, not really any competence needed. The organization surely already runs itself. This is, think about this, like, in your job, if you have someone in another department, like, imagine if you made a big show about coming out and saying, hey, we're going to steal this person from accounting over to our department. The accounting department would be pissed. Right. These are allies. Emily's List and the Biden administration are close allies. Why would they be trying to steal one of their highest profile employees? Obviously, it's because they had the approval to do this. In December, not long after word of Dunn's plan circulated the White House, Jean-Pierre received and rejected an unsolicited offer to become president of Emily's List, a major Democratic group that raises money for female candidates who support expanded abortion rights. Now, she, of course, doesn't want to go anywhere. I mean, and rightfully so. She probably sees this as the last job she ever gets, you'd think. Now, she may get bought out something like an Emily's List offer at some point. But if she just were to leave normally, who would hire her? She's obviously been terrible at this job. I mean, would you hire her, if you worked at Golden Corral? I mean, I would say no, right? Like, she'd be terrible at that job, just like she's terrible at this one. I think everyone's resigned to the fact that she's not going anywhere on her own, said the second source. She thinks she's doing a really good job and thinks the president wants her to stay. Is it possible? I mean, I honestly ask you this question. I'm not a Corinne Jean-Pierre fan, but I do ask you this question, just human nature. Is it possible she thinks she's doing a good job? I mean, is it possible to be so completely unaware of your own circumstances that you think you're doing a good job as Corinne Jean-Pierre? I don't know. It seems really unlikely to me, but maybe it's possible. What Biden really wants was unclear to the Post sources, with a third source familiar with the administration dynamics and skeptical of Jean-Pierre's performance, saying the president trusts his senior advisors to manage the team as needed. Again, kind of more evidence that he's just totally unplugged from this stuff and is not really paying attention to it at all. Now, of course, we've also seen reports of Corinne Jean-Pierre having issues with John Kirby, who's kind of the person who would normally do the job if DEI didn't exist. Right. Like, obviously, there's no reason for Corinne Jean-Pierre to have this job. And when things get tough, they usually call in John Kirby to answer the tough questions. They give her the stuff to read. They give him the questions to ask. It's just what happens. Who speaks for the president depends on whom you ask. This is a report from The New York Times going back from February 13th, 2024, right around this period where the Emily's List offer happened, right around the period where this plot was unfolding. Well, I don't know. There seems to be a problem. What about John Kirby? Could he be the one? Well, tension, of course, as this article also shows, and the reporting shows, that Kirby, who has two stints as a Pentagon press secretary under his belt, also fronted State Department's briefings in the final 20 months of the Obama administration, has shared the stage with Corinne Jean-Pierre at most White House briefings since Hamas terrorists massacred about 1,200 people on October 7th, contributing to what one source called serious tension in the West Wing. Sometimes he talks to her and she acts as if he is not talking, said a fourth source familiar with the situation and critical of Jean-Pierre. While Kirby is the odds-on favorite to replace Jean-Pierre as press secretary, should she depart the position, there are other contenders for the job, including Brian Fallon, formerly Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign press secretary. Should anyone from Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign get a job doing anything else? I mean, just they might be smart, they might be capable people, but like that on your resume, Not so great. He's currently Vice President Kamala Harris's re-election campaign communications director. Clinton and Kamala Harris. Wow, just two incredible politicians he got there. One source says she has undergone an ego detoxing in his current post. Post spoke with almost a dozen prominent Democratic staffers for this article, including current and former White House officials, all of whom requested anonymity to discuss internal personnel matters. Well, there's no question they don't want to actually be on record saying these things. But all of this adds up. There's a lot of evidence, even stuff that happened at the time this plot was unfolding, that this plot was unfolding. And we got a lot of the leakages to the media. We got a lot of the articles that came out, a lot of the unnamed sources leaking things that were going on. But like, this is just reality, right? We all can tell by just looking at these press conferences that Karine Jean-Pierre is terrible at this job. And if the president of the United States really was focused and maybe was on his game a little bit more, he'd probably be more focused on this. This is one of the most prominent people in the administration to the average everyday voter. They see her talking about this stuff all the time. When something goes wrong, she's the one supposedly going up there to defend it. And she's so terrible at this day after day after day, you'd wonder why they wouldn't make a change, why this plot wouldn't succeed. But look, identity politics, a heck of an important thing. And when you're hiring and firing people based on the color of their skin and the genitals that they have or the genitals that they prefer, these are not, I don't think there's categories for these things on ZipRecruiter. And there's a reason for that. You should be focusing on merit, not on these nonsensical categories. It's just an amazing, amazing thing that this has happened. And the media continues to act as if she's doing a decent job, which is incredible. We have more fact checking of the media here coming up with Drew Holden. He's coming up next. Ah, the Jace case from Jace Medical. Yes, these are the people trying to supply you with the medications that you need. People who care whether you are able to take control of your own health care. You know, that's one of the things. You can talk about the problems with the supply chain. This is real. We've seen it for years now, and you might not have all the access to basic things like antibiotics that you need, and the Jace case will take care of that for you. But honestly, when I talk to people myself, what I hear from them often is I like the Jace case because I like to be in control. I don't want the government in control. I certainly don't want China in control. You know who I want to be in control? Me. I want to have the stuff I need that if my doctor says, hey, this is the right thing to take, or I have a basic thing that everybody knows how to knock out, quick antibiotic course, I want the supply there. I want it available for me, and I want it there in case I need it. And now I know that I'm in control of my own health, not the government, not the government of China. JaceMedical.com is the place to go to get a Jace case. You enter the code STU at checkout. You get a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at JaceMedical.com. J-A-S-E Medical.com. It's Jace Medical.
Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Plötzlich fühle ich mich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Tiefenentspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
I want to bring in Drew Holden. He is a commentary writer and purveyor of the brand new Substack, Holden Court, unpacking what the media got wrong. Be sure to check it out at drewholden.substack.com. Drew, welcome and congratulations on the new project.
Stu, thank you, sir. I appreciate you having me back on and appreciate the good words. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, you know, and let me start with the Substack before we get into, you know, what you've been covering. Just the approach of it, which I thought was interesting. You wrote in the intro to the entire project, you're talking about connecting the dots. Some of these examples won't be new, but some of the primary source material is, it's, and that's the value I'm trying to provide, more archaeologist or historian than talking head or pundit. That's an interesting approach. Can you explain it?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, so I think one of the things that I've always struggled with a little bit when it comes to media criticism is that the things that people tend to gravitate to are the breaking news stories. It's finding press angles on other stories of things that are happening out in the world, which is important and valuable. But I worry that it's also impressionistic, right? It's based on what we're kind of feeling or believe in the moment. And that one of the things that we don't do particularly well on the right in media criticism in general is kind of record history as it happens, right? The press talks about itself as writing the first rough draft of history, which is true. But when they get things wrong, we still see that first rough draft being the thing that's entered into history. And what I'm trying to do is something that's it's a little bit slower, it's a little bit deeper, I think, which is trying to unpack how the media messes up these major stories, right? The things that are going to be in the history books 10, 20, 50, 100 years hence, and try and explore those in better ways to critique that rough draft, to do a better job at encouraging people to understand what really happened, regardless of what the press may have said about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting approach, because this happens to me all the time. You know, we're prepping the show or whatever, and I'll say, remember when they used to say this all the time? And we'll all kind of nod our heads and sort of remember it. But like, I don't have a bunch of examples at hand. I mean, that takes obviously, as you know, hours and hours and hours and hours to put together. I'm happy to know that you're going to be doing all the show prep for the show. Thank you so much for that.
that's right. I mean, honestly, earnestly, I hope that it can be a resource for other people because people don't do it. And like, how could you possibly have the time, right? If you're keeping up with the breaking news and all of the things that exist beyond the media, right? Everything that's happening in a Democratic administration, that's happening in the United States in 2024. You can't possibly have this kind of the time and the energy to pull back through the wreckage of all of these things that, like, again, we all kind of know. Like, we kind of know that the press were bad about the lab leak. We kind of know they were bad about COVID when it first came out. But I worry that we're kind of forgetting the ways that they were bad. And in some cases, the extent to which they were bad, again, on some of these really enormous, really important stories.
Yeah, I think that it's a really interesting thing. And I think I wish there was, and hopefully this is the start of it, a more of a premium on the scoreboard, right? Like, we always see because I'm with you, like, we get in these things, a story breaks, we're talking about it for a few days, it goes away, we never think of it again. And instead, like, we need those lookbacks, you know, 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later, whatever happened with that, and not only just whatever happened with it, but how should we judge the original source again? Have they apologized for these mistakes? Have they tried to rectify this in any way? Or are they just hoping that Drew Holden doesn't notice?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I think it's really the latter, right? I think they're just hoping that people aren't going to notice the ways that they screwed these things up. Or in many cases, I think the press themselves have just completely moved on. Right. We saw this in the early COVID coverage. We had a lot of different outlets who were talking about how the only way we could possibly stop this thing was with harsh measures, with lockdowns, by tracking people, by not letting them out of their homes. They were saying these aren't opinion pieces. They're not even editorial pieces. This is reporting pieces saying this is it. This is fact. This is truth. And they just kind of moved on beyond it. And so what I'm trying to do is, I guess, kind of be that look back premium, right? To be able to look back and say, no, actually, you aren't doing these things, and reach out, be it on Twitter or on email or what have you, and go back to these pubs and say, you got to fix this. Like, these are the sorts of things we're going to be reading about years later. And maybe you've moved on, maybe you've forgotten, but I haven't. And a lot of other people haven't either. And it's one of the big reasons, I think, why you see media trust hovering, you know, somewhere near the Congress and, you know, a Chinese lab in Wuhan in terms of trust among the American people.
And you said those in reverse order. Chinese lab in Wuhan is actually higher than Congress, just to get the polling accurate.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a really interesting approach. I'm really glad you're doing this. You know, I see this, you see this kind of happen all the time. And I know for me, I would have more faith in the media, especially to believe things I was skeptical of, if they were honest to come back after these things and said, gosh, you know what? We really did blow, for example, the COVID lab leak theory. Like, we were wrong on that. Here's where we were wrong. Here's how we'll do better in the future. Like, I wouldn't hate an organization for doing that. I would respect them more.
I would too. And Stu, I think most people would, right? Like, one of the reasons I want to do this, and people kind of chide me from time to time, Steve did on his show the other day, that, you know, I'm a little bit too earnest, or I'm a little bit too optimistic about what the press could be. But I really do believe deep down that, like, real people out there who read the New York Times, who read USA Today, who watch CNN, they really would appreciate this. They really would look at this and say, oh, wow, I appreciate you coming back to this thing, because it's not lost on people, right? I think the reason the threads get pretty good engagement online is because people haven't forgotten these things. And maybe they've forgotten the details. Maybe they don't remember the headlines. Maybe they don't remember the specific wording, but they remember the press blew this story. And I really do think when you have a free and fair press that can't be trusted by the average viewer at home, you have something that's really, really problematic and dangerous and harmful for an operating democracy.
I totally agree with you. Let me go to the COVID Lab leak. This is the first, you know, big piece that you wrote for the site, for the new Substack. And, you go back and you look at the coverage. And again, my remembrance of this, there's a couple that I remember. Like, I remember NPR being really egregious on this. I remember a couple of headlines. But you put together a ton of them, and this coverage was even worse than I even remembered it.
Yeah, Stu, I went back through, one of the reasons I wanted to write the story was because I had gone back through some of the screenshots that I have in my phone. As you can imagine, my phone is kind of a wasteland of bad takes. And I just clicked through and I saw a couple and I was like, oh, wow, I don't remember that USA Today fact check, right? And so I started to peel back and I was like, oh, this is actually considerably worse than even I remember. And if I'm the guy who's supposed to remember these things, right? Like if my kind of niche on the internet is being the guy who remembers how media got things wrong, and I'm forgetting this stuff, I can't imagine that the average person who has like a real life to go out and live out there is going to remember these things any better. And so I started to look at them, and I remember the USA Today one really sticks out in my head because they did eventually update it, which I think is the power of correcting the media on these things. But it was so egregiously bad to start with. They took the Tom Cotton claim, the idea that not definitively that COVID came out of this lab, but that the lab leak was plausible, that it was a theory worth talking about. They took that claim, maybe it happened, and they described it as false. Not maybe false, not partially false, not we don't know well enough to know. It's this thing he said was a possibility cannot possibly exist. And I looked at that and I thought to myself, my goodness, this is USA Today. This is on newsstands in every hotel all across the country. Its readership is enormous. You know, behind Reuters and behind AP, it has like the largest, and maybe New York Times now, it has one of the largest circulations in the world. And this is what they told their readers. And I saw that and I was like, even if they've gotten enough comeuppance where they've changed some of the wording and they've updated this fact check, they definitely haven't gotten enough grief for just how awful and misleading this story was.
Yeah.
And that probably goes for a lot of other outlets too.
And that next step never seems to come. I mean, I appreciate they made a correction, but part of that process needs to be, what do we do better next time? When we see a story that might agree with our worldview, how do we not immediately embrace it? Like, is there a process that these places can put in place that would take their worst instincts and just mute them a little bit? I mean, we understand they're all liberal. We understand they're all going to take the whatever Trump says, they're going to take the opposite side of that as their instinct. But like, they need to be able to be checking themselves real time so they don't get over their skis.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Stu. I think there's two things that jump out to me. One, and this was an effort back in 2016 that never really materialized, is just hire like one person who isn't, you know, to the left of Mao Zedong on a lot of these issues, right? Like, if you even had like the old normie liberals, I think, in a lot of these newsrooms, or who at least felt comfortable calling the shots in these newsrooms, then I think you might have someone who is more willing to stick their hand up and say, hey, I'm not actually quite sure that we should be this definitive in our straight news coverage. I'm not sure that makes sense. So I think that's one angle. And the other angle, I think, is just to be a little bit slower, right? Like, I think one of the things I say in the Substack is these pieces, I'm not going to be following breaking stories because it's not possible, right? The whole point is that we want to look at these things after the dust has settled a little bit more. And so what I wish the media would do, and unfortunately the incentives are kind of arrayed against doing so, but is to just take a beat and fact check and talk to people and get the right information before they step in it.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea because you're never going to beat Twitter on the hot, fast take. Like, realize you're something else. Realize you're providing a different service. And you mentioned, like, having the one even normie liberal. I mean, if you think about who, like, The Times had those people. They fired them when the Tom Cotton op-ed thing went on. Mm-hmm. Barry Weiss is gone, right? Like, these are people that used to be, to at least have a voice inside the organization that could say, hey, we're a little crazy on this one. Maybe we should back off. Yep. It feels to me, though, that this sort of up-and-coming younger generation, the AOC sort of left rather than the old-school Democrat, has taken over these newsrooms, and they don't want any of these real-time fact checks. They'd rather just be wrong and kind of have this approach that they accuse Trump of, right? Of just like, if you're wrong in the moment, just move on and everyone's going to forget it in a couple of days.
Yep, exactly. I think that's unfortunately exactly what you're seeing. And, you know, you've got these extremely liberal journalism schools that are putting out graduates who feel this way. They feel like they are compelled to do advocacy, to like their purpose is not just reporting facts. It's not kind of the dry doldrum of reporting. It's you have to have an impact. And I worry that by hiring people who think that way, forgetting, even setting aside what their politics might be, hiring people who think that way and getting rid of these old guard people who maybe see the world a little bit different, who maybe see journalism a little different, is really just going to result in the media doing this over and over again. And so I'm trying to kind of put up my flag and say, hey, this is what's happening. You guys can do better. And here's how I think you should do it next time. And don't forget, here's how you screwed it up last time.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. Drew Holden, this is a great effort. I think an important effort. Of course, Drew is a commentary writer. You can follow him on Twitter where he has lots of great stuff. But the new Substack is important to get involved in. It's Holden Court, Unpacking What the Media Got Wrong. It's at drewholden.substack.com. Go there, sign up today. Drew, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Stu, the pleasure's mine. Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
Every once in a while, we talk about the worst case scenarios, and you think about what do you do in those situations? You got to have some food storage, and that's really important. I went to my Patriot Supply a long time ago and was like, you know, maybe I need some stuff for the who knows what's going on in this world. Let me just have something I can stick in the back of my closet and keep for 20 years and never have to think about again. And that is a really important thing to do. If you haven't done that yet, I encourage you go to preparewithstew.com and get that from my Patriot Supply. They also have this continuous food supply idea, which is basically like a survival seed vault from my Patriot Supply. They've been helping people prepare since 2008. My Patriot Supply is fully equipped to help you with every element of self-reliance you need. They got all of it. They know how to do this better than anybody. The Survival Seed Vault from my Patriot Supply and Patriot Seeds is a never-ending source of fresh fruits and vegetables. 20 varieties of zone-friendly, 100% heirloom seeds, triple-sealed to protect against the elements. You can plant them right away. That's a great idea. Get some fresh fruit and vegetables. Or you can wait like 5 years or more and plant them when you need them. Grow, harvest, and replant fresh, delicious beans, greens, tomatoes, melons, and so much more, go to preparewithstew.com. Preparewithstew.com. Get your survival seed vault and start planning a food supply that never stops. It's preparewithstew.com from My Patriot Supply. So we mentioned this a little bit on State of the Race the other day. Podcast, by the way, you can subscribe to in the Stu Does America feed. But it is, they had a VP sort of gathering potential VPs for Trump. Here's who was there: Marco Rubio, Tim Scott, JD Vance, Mike Lee. Now, Mike Lee's not seen as a presidential candidate or VP candidate. At least I haven't heard that. Would love that, but I don't think that's going to happen. Marsha Blackburn, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, Representative Elise Stefanik, Byron Donalds, another representative, Wesley Hunt, and Michael Waltz. It's an interesting gathering here. Here's what he said about J.D. Vance. He wasn't a supporter of mine at the very beginning. He said things like, this guy's going to be a total disaster. Anyways, I got to know him a little bit. And as a non-politician, he's become one of the great senators. Now, that hits two things that Trump likes. One, a non-politician. Two, people who used to hate him and he's won over. And that's a profile of people that he likes. So we will see if any of those get selected. I still think J.D. Vance has a chance. That's who I thought out of that group had the best chance. But we will see going forward. Biden, Trump deadlocked in a national survey. This is 37-37 is what the poll came out at. RFK Jr. had 8%. 5% had other third party or independent candidates. Look, there's no way, I don't think, that these two candidates are below 40%. I don't think that's even remotely possible, but it is where polling is showing right now. It's still early, though. And I keep saying this to people, like, they're like, oh, what's going to happen? Look, it's too early to know, honestly. These things can change dramatically from here. We are getting within 6 months now, so it's maybe time to at least look at this stuff. But there you go. And finally, the idea with the Biden's general election strategy seems to be less is more. And I completely agree with the strategy. If I was Joe Biden's people, I would say the exact same thing. But, you know, they ran the sort of like COVID campaign where they never came out of their basement. This is last time. And now they're going to basically try this again. Here's NBC News talking about it.
We have news this morning from NBC News that the campaign is looking to shorten its speeches. Biden's general election strategy is less is more. The president's aides are seeking to tighten his pitch to voters with shorter, crisper speeches. To be honest with you, Quentin, I think that's a very smart idea. I think
for everyone.
I really I appreciate that approach because it is a way for the president to sort of hit with clarity, stick his points and move on and not get lost and sidetracked. Give us a little bit more of the scene setting around the thinking there and trying to reimagine the campaign going forward with what you just said and this idea now of the president tighten his grip on his speeches.
Look, our campaign believes in quality over quantity. We believe that these touches, these smaller things that are getting directly to the point about what is going on in the stakes of this election are going to be easier for voters to tap into and sort of also go out and say and talk to their friends and family about what's at stake.
Quality over quantity. What a great, that is fantastic. Look, they are in a tough spot, to be honest with you. So what are you going to do? Basically, you just need to step back, let all this happen, keep them off TV as much as possible, cross your fingers, and hope for the best. It's really your only approach, and it's the only approach the Biden administration has to go forward with. We'll talk about the latest electric vehicle disaster, this time with auto expert Paul Bryan. He's coming up next. Prize Picks is America's number one fantasy sports app. I'm a member. I've loved it. I've been doing it for a long time, and more than 5 million members, one of them me. You can get on. I think it's the best way to get on with fantasy sports right now. It's a great addition to watching, you know, the NBA playoffs, for example, that are going on right now. You tune in, you put a couple of picks in on Prize Picks, and then it's just you against the numbers. You just pick two or more players and then pick more or less on their projected stats. I just did one of these the other day and had a winner, by the way. Had a shot at 46 times my money. And Kyrie Irving had 2 points in the first half. I had the under for Kyrie Irving, and then he wound up with 30, and so I didn't get it. But I did get 5 times my money on that particular play. Donovan Mitchell I had on that one, Norman Powell, Derek Lively. It was a good night on Prize Picks. I've had a bunch of them, and it's fun because you just kind of go on and pick over or under. You feel like even if you don't know anything about the sport, you've got a 50-50 chance of getting these things right. And, of course, it's a great way to go. This is a fun way to see the playoff action that's going on in the NBA. You can win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks. And all you have to do is watch the games and play along. It's a lot of fun. Download the app today. I think it's in 30 states now. Use the code STU for a first deposit match of up to $100. The code is STU on Prize Picks for a deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. It's really up to you. It's Prize Picks. Check it out. I'm happy to welcome back the great Paul Bryan to the program. He's an Emmy Award-winning automotive expert and the editor-at-large for Car Coach Reports. Paul, how's it going?
It's going well. It was darn near 70 degrees in Chicago, and what can be wrong with that?
Oh, good. We bring on the global warming, Paul. Bring it on. Believe me, I want more of it. I wanted to bring you on because I've been fascinated by this change, and I know you watch everything in the auto industry so closely. This change in sort of messaging to the public about what's going on with electric vehicles. We've been told forever that every company is going to be switching over to all electric, you know, by whatever it is, 2030. But we're starting to see a lot of messages come out from these companies. Maybe we're not going to go that far. I want to start with this one for Mercedes-Benz. And one word really struck me in this. They said that they were going to say, they initially said that 2030, they were only going to sell electric vehicles. They are now saying that it might be in 2030, instead of 100%, only 50% electric vehicles, a massive cut. And they say this, it's not going to be 100% in 2030. Here's the key word, obviously. Like, they're no longer even trying to give you the optimism that it's possible at this point. What is going on?
What's going on is a healthy dose of basic economics. They're finding out that the panacea that they thought was going to be the electric car and the adopters who were going to be buying them have not only leveled off, but they have actually taken a drop down. And it's, you know, all of a sudden they're saying, hey, guys, we are still selling a small percentage of what we're doing. And as much as we would like to have, you know, this is Mercedes-Benz. I mean, my gosh, to have all of their production in the wink of an eye in terms of automotive years. 6 years is nothing in the car business. And for them to say, you know what, we better have a backstop plan because we're just not getting the action that we're seeing and the adoption. Why? For a vast array of numbers, infrastructure, capacity, the amount of early adopters seems to have leveled off. There were a lot of people who said, gee, I got to have that. It's the latest thing. It's the newest thing. And then they get the reality of living with it. And then they find out that, well, charging, unless you're charging at home, which excludes many condos, many apartment buildings, maybe even public parking spaces that don't allow charging, is still a big, big challenge, irrespective of what the administration says.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to see how widespread this is. And I've known people who have bought, you know, Teslas and stuff, and were excited about them and liked them for a little while, and then realized, well, there's this problem with it and this issue, and I'm having this problem with it. A lot of them are like, can't wait to get back into a gas-powered car. And it, sure. it seems like that's not just anecdotal. You know, Tesla is saying the company is bracing for significantly lower sales growth in 2024. Of course, Rivian and Lucid have had all sorts of problems. I wrote down the stock prices of these electric vehicle startups are just catastrophes, Paul. Lucid is down 95%. Rivian is down 94%. Nikola is down 99%. And I guess the highlight for the electric vehicles is Polestar, only down 91%. This is sort of a catastrophe.
99%. But it's not 99%.
Much better. Much better, Paul.
Yes. I mean, we have to look at the bright side of things. Yeah, they're in a bad, bad economic position on these vehicles. A lot of people are hanging on by their fingernails trying to say, can we get a cash raise? Can we still save this? I saw a fellow with a Lucid Sunday at a charging station, which my weekend run just simply up to Road America to the racetrack, 150 miles, and I had a Kia EV9. Well, the range on that is about 225, 230, and that practically. And so I was recharging, and you seem to want to watch the range gauge more carefully than you want to watch the speedometer or anything else that's going on. I said, hey, how's it going? Obviously, you've spent a boatload of money on this car. And he said, well, it's a good-looking car. And I said, yeah, it really is a handsome car, but it's nothing that a V6 turbo wouldn't cure. He said, I got to tell you, I have thought of that many, many times. You know, it just gets to be a hassle. And from an infrastructure standpoint, just finding level 3 chargers is really, really tough. And on top of that, you can't get a roller dog, you know, and do that. They don't have those.
It really does seem just a difficult.
That was a joke, Stu.
Yeah, no,
not much of one.
Let me move over to, I think, maybe the worst sign of all of this in a way. Is Apple. Apple has been kind of behind the scenes been pitching this eventual iCar of sorts, where they're going to come up with their own electric vehicle system. And they've been working on it for a really long time. And
16.
And I think like what's fascinating about them is like they have a streaming. I was just talking to a friend about this. They have a streaming video business where they churn out like 5 shows a year that are all massively expensive. And like, I don't know, it just seems like it's a prestige business. It's like a, hey, they get to talk about it in their executive parties. Because I mean, comparing it to the iPhone, right? Like it's nothing. They have money. They can just blow money as much as they want on streaming programming. And it doesn't even matter. They have this situation going on with the car, which they could continue to throw money at and not worry about given the size of their multi-trillion-dollar company. And even they are looking at this and saying, you know what? Maybe this isn't worth it. Why is this all happening?
Well, I think they've discovered that building a car is a heck of a lot more difficult than building a phone. And they make a darn nice phone. I've got it myself, and I use them all the time. And I use an iPad, and I'm on an iMac. But when you start working on something as complex as an automobile or a truck, it's a whole different bag of worms. And they thought that they might pick off a couple of people. They hired an engineer from Ford Motor Company to head the engineering part of it. And it's just remarkably different. The planning stages on cars, even the stuff that we are seeing today as brand new cars, that happened, that's so 7-8 years ago in terms of the automobile business. It's just more difficult. And I think somebody finally made the decision to say, look, why don't we stick to our core business and do this? And on top of that, everybody was saying, look, the sales numbers that we're seeing don't justify what's going on. And it's not on an uphill climb. The manufacturers are in a tough, tough spot. They have a choice of either getting fined by the government for not producing electric vehicles, or they get to pay to a company like Tesla for carbon credits. And they're kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't, and they're going to pay one way or the other. And we've seen most recently, I think the best example might be the F-150 Lightning, where they were all ganged up for 3 shifts, and boy, we're going to go, and we've got so many reservations. They're down to 1 shift on the F-150 Lightning, and it's a darn nice truck, but you know, people just aren't buying them. Yeah. You can drive by car stores in the Dallas area, and you'll see tons of Mach-E Fords, and the dealers that I talk to, and the sales numbers bear it out, they're selling regular vehicles, gas ICE vehicles, if you're internal combustion. And sitting over here on the side is a big supply of Mach-Es. We had thousands of dealers begging the administration to ease up on these regulations that are being forced upon them, even to the point where there were Buick dealers, a significant number of Buick dealers, who said, look, we'll give up our franchise. There's no sense in us keeping the doors open if this is all you're going to give us to sell. It's market driven. It's not hard to figure out. But the government, of course, always finds a way to mess it up.
Yeah, you said it, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like, that could be like the slogan for Bidenomics. That's kind of like, I think you should use that in the campaign, Paul. You're writing copy for him as we go. Paul, thanks so much. Emmy-winning, automotive expert, editor-at-large of Car Coach Reports. Dude knows everything about cars, and I always go to him whenever I can because Paul, you just...
How's your car doing, by the way? Are you still enjoying?
I am very much enjoying my car. Yes, my car it is not electric, and it gets very low gas mileage, and I absolutely love it.
I'll ask you one quick question.
Yes.
is the interior leather.
It is. It is. And it's nice. I very much like it.
How do you know it's leather?
I don't know. They told me on the sheet.
And thereby, we're going to set up our next visit.
Ah, interesting. All right. We've got some intrigue, a little cliffhanger from Paul Bryan. Paul, thanks so much for coming on the program, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. Good to be with you again.
My wife was at a Home Depot the other day, and someone came up to her and said, "Oh, my gosh, I thought for a second that was a pro-Biden T-shirt." And I've never seen one of those before. And it's true, it's very rare to see one of those, but this was not a pro-Biden shirt. It was the Joe Biden elderly man with a poor memory shirt she had on. It's great because people think it's pro-Biden, then they come up and they have a really hard laugh when they see what it actually is. Get it at StuDoesMerch.com. StuDoesMerch.com, code is Stu10.